Good morning. It's 7 minutes past 6 o'clock. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell, and I'll be here this week filling in for Joy Cardine. Food safety has been on the minds of a lot of us since the news of the E. coli outbreak in Europe. There, a new strain of E. coli, which has left over 30 people dead and thousands seriously ill. The outbreak has been traced back to bean sprouts grown on a specific farm, and it's causing a lot of people to pause for a moment to give some thought as to where their food comes from and what the implications of the outbreak in Europe might be for consumers here in the U.S. Mark Castell is with us this hour. He is the co-director and senior farm policy analyst at the Cornucopia Institute. Based in Wisconsin, the Institute's website says it will engage in educational activities supporting the ecological principles and economic wisdom underlying sustainable and organic agriculture. We'd like to hear from you on this topic as well. Is there anything new in this E. coli outbreak for you? Has it caused you to think seriously about where food comes from and the implications of our current agricultural system? Become part of the discussion by phone. Our toll-free number is 800-642-1234. That is 800-642-1234. We'll also be taking questions and comments on email. That address is talk@wpr.org. And don't forget, you can also follow the Joy Cardine Show on Facebook as well. Mark Castell, good morning. Welcome to Wisconsin Public Radio.
Hi, Gene. Nice to talk to you again.
Yep, it's been a long time, but it's good to have you with us, and we've got some things to discuss this hour. First thing I'd like to start with is, you know, when I think when a lot of people heard that bean sprouts were somehow involved or could be involved in this outbreak, they may have been surprised by that, and I'm wondering if you were.
Well, not really. They're a sensitive food that has been implicated in some other pathogenetic outbreaks. Normally it's salmonella that's the problem, but there have been E. coli problems before. And so that's not news. I thought maybe I'd start by throwing out a couple factoids here.
Sure.
There is obviously news here. And first, let me say that the only silver lining to this very dark cloud, you'd have to say that when over 30 people die and over 3,000 people are seriously injured by an illness, that you know, it's hard to see a good come out of this. But the fact that we're seriously talking about our food supply and I think this hour, the root causes of some of our problems, I think that will pay dividends in the future for our society. I sure hope so. So first of all, sprouts. And you're one of the few journalists that didn't use the word organic when identifying this, quote, farm, because some of the organics is still very threatening to corporate agribusiness, and there are right-wing think tanks and journalists and that really like to impugn organics' reputation when they can, and here's a great opportunity because it looks like these were certified organic sprouts. The fact is that in the United States, at least, the tracking by the FDA over recent years indicates that 90% of all sprout problems, and there have been problems with sprouts, have come from conventional producers, not organic. And my guess is it's quite a misnomer to call this a organic farm because sprout production has nothing to do with farming. They're not grown in the ground. They're grown hydroponically, so they're grown in a medium of water. In special equipment, in a humid, wet environment that tends to breed microorganisms. And so this, quote, farm could have been in an industrial park somewhere. I really don't know the intimate details of how this production was done. So although the word's been bantied about, this has way more to do with sprout production than anything in terms of organics. But there are a lot of, to answer your initial question, there are a lot of food safety experts in this country who are saying they won't eat sprouts. And I would say that they are problematic. The contamination in the past has been focused and tracked to the seed supply itself, which are the same as the seed supply for agronomic crops. So if you're talking about alfalfa sprouts, we grow a lot of alfalfa here in Wisconsin. It's grown in soil. It's grown specifically for livestock feed, mostly dairy cows, and that same seed can become contaminated the seed itself, even though sprout producers wash with chlorine, sometimes that the microorganisms can be embedded in crevices in this seed that can't be addressed. I can tell you one difference between organic sprout producers and non-organic is that they're inspected at least once a year because they can't use roticides and pesticides. It's incumbent upon them, and the inspection includes checking their storage facilities, that they're tightly sealed, that no rodents can get in, because that's one of the vectors that these pesky critters like this new E. coli strain can enter the food chain.
Are there significant differences between, because I imagine there's a lot of people out there say, well, that was in Europe, and here in the U.S. it's different, maybe better, maybe worse, I don't know. But are there differences between European and American food standards? Food safety standards?
There are differences, but they're harmonized to a great extent. I would say the Europeans might be even more serious than we are about food safety inspections. We have unfortunately paid lip service in our industrial sector of food supply. You can recall the major outbreak of contamination of eggs in Iowa not too long ago. And some of those major scale plants hadn't been inspected in literally years. So part of the new legislation that went through Congress should give more resources to the FDA. We have, in many cases, strict protocols on the books. We just don't have tough enforcement.
Yeah, I want to talk about that a little bit, about some of this new legislation, because I think there is a perception sometimes among Americans that somebody out there someplace is watching out for our best interests. But as we find out, the egg outbreak you talked about, some of the other issues that have occurred over the years, it's not necessarily so. And what is the state of food safety these days in America, in your opinion?
Well, I'd say it's improving because the awareness level is improving. But there's a big elephant in the room, Gene, that hasn't been discussed, and that we keep on banging this drum, but the Cornucopia Institute is a minor player in food safety nationally. We principally act as a organic industry watchdog and an advocate for small farmers, which I think is in to a great degree the antidote to this bigger problem. But the elephant in the room is where these organisms are coming from, these deadly organisms, to begin with. And I like to say there's nothing inherently dangerous about bean sprouts, regardless whether alfalfa or mung bean or whatever. There's nothing inherently dangerous about eggs or raw spinach, for that matter, which you can recall was quite concerning a couple years ago, 2007. You have to put fecal material on these fresh foods. And the reason they're dangerous is we normally don't, always don't cook spinach. Sometimes we do. And we don't normally cook bean sprouts. And so whether we're talking about salad greens or raw cucumbers, raw foods have some degree of danger because they're grown out in the environment. What we introduce as men, as mankind, men and women who are involved in industrial agriculture, is we've decided that to produce the cheapest quality and quantity of meat, that we would do so on giant feedlots with literally thousands of cows each, feeding them a high grain ration for ruminants, for cows, beef cows and dairy cows. These creatures were designed by God to eat grass. That's what most of the landmass was covered by, at least in North America. And now we're feeding them high, intensive rations of grain, and it changes the pH in their rumen, and it creates a hospitable environment for these organisms like the dangerous strains of E. coli. And then we magnify this by the fact that because these animals aren't designed to eat mostly corn, they are sick animals. They're morbidly obese. Most of them are the beef cattle diabetic. And so we create this really unfortunate, unhealthy environment, and then those organisms get released to the environment. Most of that manure is spread on farmland somewhere, and it gets into our surface and groundwater. It becomes fugitive dust, which was a suspect in the spinach problem in California. And then it gets into our meals and our guts, and then it makes people sick and kills them. And we know how to cure this. We change the way we raise livestock.
All right, lots to talk about. Mark Castell is with us from the Cornucopia Institute this hour, and we are talking about food safety in the wake of the E. coli outbreak that recently took place in Europe, and we're living through some of the ramifications of that right now. And we'll be getting back to your calls in just a moment. 800-642-1234 is our toll-free number if you'd like to weigh in. 800-642-1234. We have an open line for you right now. Taking a look at Wisconsin weather for today, partly cloudy skies are forecast for the state with mild temperatures as well. Highs will be in the low to mid-70s. Tonight, it's going to be partly to mostly cloudy with a chance of showers, possibly some thunderstorms in the west. Otherwise, lows in the low 40s to mid-50s. And then tomorrow, partly to mostly cloudy skies with a chance of rain, possibly some thunderstorms across much of the state. Expect highs in the low to mid-70s. Around Wisconsin, in Green Bay, it's 53. Superior reports 52. It's 48 in Clear and Wausau. It is 43 in Eau Claire, 49 in Oshkosh, 59 in La Crosse. It's 54 in Madison, and Milwaukee reports 52 degrees under clear skies. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 20 minutes past 6 o'clock, this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up this afternoon with Ben Marins after 5, loyalty is often seen as a virtue, but it can also come with a cost. At issue with Ben Marins after 5, we'll talk about the role that loyalty plays in our lives and some of the challenges that it presents. This hour, we're talking about food safety with Mark Castell from the Cornucopia Institute based in Wisconsin. The Institute says that it will engage in educational activities that support the ecological principles and economic wisdom underlying sustainable and organic agriculture. Mark Castell, before the break, we were talking about some of the underlying causes, as you see it, in food safety issue. And I'm wondering about the reporting side of things. Do we hear about problems that come up, or are a lot of them just sort of don't ever rise to that level where they're serious enough that we find out about them?
Well, I can't quote the exact statistics, but every year millions of people suffer from, quote, the stomach flu. And most of the time in the food business, this is referred to as, quote, fecal oral. Somehow we ingest some kind of fecal matter from some kind of source, and sometimes it's unsanitary food handling at restaurants or stores or in the fields where the produce is picked. And sometimes it's a much more serious strain of outbreak that makes you sick for more than just 24 hours. So it's out there all the time. It's kind of incumbent upon us to pay attention. Unfortunately, most people feel like they're playing Russian roulette here because we trust the food distribution system, and these contaminants can happen anywhere from the farm field to the plate. And the bright news here is, and I wanted to speak about the antidote, and that's besides for the meteoric growth in organics, and there is some evidence that organic food is safer. Certainly, if we don't want knowingly toxic and carcinogenic chemicals in our food supply, organic food is way safer. But even testing contamination, some of the livestock is lower. But what's surpassed the growth of organics is what we refer to as the local food movement, and that's the farmers market around the square in Madison or in Marshfield or Viroqua, and there are now over 6,000 farmers markets around the country. According to the USDA, I think that's a grossly underreported number. People are joining CSAs, that's a community-supported agricultural farm, where they sign up at the beginning of the year and buy a percentage of the farm's produce and receive a fresh box every day, not picked a week ago in California, but picked maybe the day before, right around your community in Wisconsin, very fresh and nutritious food. And farm stands, The Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection maintains a website called SaverWisconsin.org, and that's where you can connect with farmers directly to buy your meat and eggs and other produce. And Gene, these trends are growing exponentially, and this is where consumers are finding more meaning in their food, flavor, nutrition, and trust, because they're meeting the farmers. And I can tell you, as an ex-certified organic fresh vegetable producer in Wisconsin, we have a very unique protocol for testing on these owner-operated, craftsman-level farms, and that's the crops, the delicate crops we harvest during the summer at 5 or 6 a.m. in the cool mornings and the dew are on our tables at lunchtime for our families and our staff. And if there's a health problem, we're the very first ones to know about it. We share the risks, and the risks for that type of agriculture are exceedingly low.
Well, let's find out what listeners have to add to the discussion here. Miranda starts us off, and Miranda's in Kenosha this morning. Hi.
Hi. Yeah, no, I find this all to be very interesting. And one of the things I had a question and a comment about was, not only do I agree with the fact that they shouldn't be fed on these corn diets because they're making animals extremely sick, but then we also pump them full of growth hormones and antibiotics to kind of counterweigh those sick effects. And I tend to think that that, too, has got to be having an issue with human development. I mean, it just doesn't seem like that's something that's just going to go into your system and not change something.
Miranda, thanks for the call. Mark Castell, can we look far ahead enough to see some of those issues? Or we're just talking about food safety today, but are there larger issues there that you're concerned about?
Well, I think they're integrated. Miranda's making an excellent point. About 80% of our antibiotics that are produced in this country, or used in this country at any rate, lots of them come from China and India, about 80% are administered to livestock. And these aren't therapeutic administrations. These aren't because a cow has scratched her leg on a barbed wire fence and it's become infected and we're treating her the same way we might treat our child. Almost all these antibiotics administered to livestock are administered subtherapeutically. It's either in their feed or their water. They're getting them all the time, either to prevent disease because they're in such an abysmal environment, or because we figured out by chance that cattle or poultry gain, or hogs, more weight if they're medicated. And so we're developing organisms that are resistant and releasing those into the environment, resistant to antibiotics, very dangerous. And there's some conjecture. I have some email in front of me right now from a microbiologist I've been corresponding with, that these antibiotics are helping breed the very virulent strains, that these deadly strains of the E. coli organism. I don't think that's been scientifically proven yet. That's what they're looking at very closely. So Miranda's point is very well taken.
Let's go to Horicon right now, and Elizabeth joins us. Hi, Elizabeth.
Good morning. My question is in reference to raw foods. I eat a great deal of vegetables and just a very little bit of meat, and I do frequent the farmers markets in the summer. In the winter, though, kind of all bets are off, and we buy most of our produce from the store. And all we've ever done precautionary is just rinse all of our vegetables very thoroughly. And I'm wondering if that's still a recommended way to kill off or rinse off whatever organisms or bugs are actually on the vegetables, or if there's a new recommendation as far as getting the vegetables clean.
Well, Elizabeth, you're doing what you can do. In most cases, contamination, I talked about the potential vector of unsanitary situation. Maybe the workers are sick themselves. Most of that will occur on the surface of the produce, whether it's been contaminated, being picked in the farm field or at a restaurant. And so you're well advised to rinse under running water, but to also use a brush and some abrasive action because that's what's going to remove the particulate matters, which some of which could be contaminated. There are some instances where the produce is actually systemically contaminated, and then washing isn't going to do much. But you're doing what you can do, and then there's lots of debate whether we should be eating all these fresh produce items out of season, and most of them come from either California or Mexico during the winter, and then we're rolling those dice again. So a lot of people are eating a more seasonal diet. They're canning from their own gardens, or they're buying from local snowpack organic foods in Minnesota, wonderfully quick frozen products, or they're eating a lot of root crops, the winter squashes and the turnips and potatoes and other things in the winter where we can take them out of the basement. But if you want to eat exclusively raw diet, you're challenged, obviously.
We've only got about a minute left before the break, but you know, you mentioned washing the vegetables or crops underneath some just water, but you can see these solutions in the store, the supermarket occasionally. Are those worth investing in?
I haven't seen conclusive evidence. I mean, obviously they're marketed, so they're going to spin the story, but I haven't seen conclusive evidence, nor have I read peer-reviewed recommendations that we use those. I mean, they might very well work. I mean, obviously a very dilute chlorine or bleach solution also kills some organisms. You're going to have to decide whether the risk is high enough to handle those materials and then that they're rinsed off properly and not incorporated in your food supply.
Mark Castell is with us this hour from the Cornucopia Institute, and we are talking about the wide-ranging issues surrounding food safety this hour. We'll be taking your calls. We've got news coming up next. 800-642-1234 is our toll-free number. You can also join us by email, talk@WPR.org. I'm Gene Purcell in for Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. It's 25 minutes before 7 o'clock. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell, filling in this week for Joy Cardine. Mark Castell is with us this hour, the co-director and senior farm policy analyst at the Cornucopia Institute, based here in Wisconsin, and we are talking about the issue of food safety this hour. What happened a week or so ago in Europe with the breakout of E. coli has spurred a lot of discussion, not just around the country, but around the world, about food safety. And that is what we are talking about. 800-642-1234 is the number. You can join in if you'd like. Let's start with the phones, and we'll go to Shawno. And Lee is with us. Good morning.
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah, Gene. Yeah, so nice to have you this morning.
Well,
I
thanks.
I missed you. Yeah, I really missed you. You're wonderful. Mark, yeah, I have a two-part question, dear, and I'll take my answers off the air. Number one, would there be a great difference between frozen and fresh vegetables? That's question one. And then question number two is, any chance for it, I know it's almost impossible to answer this, but any chance for it entering into U.S. to us people here? Thank you.
Sure. Lee, frozen vegetables are most likely safe. I mean, obviously, these pathogens can be introduced into the food chain at any juncture, including your kitchen. So when we handle meat or poultry, it's very important to segregate this in your kitchen, kind of have a flow from dirty to clean, so to speak. You should have separate cutting boards. You should wash very carefully, maybe even with a dilute bleach solution after you handle meat products, because you can take fresh raw food and contaminate that by using the same cutting boards, meat, or your hands or your countertop. But frozen food is usually blanched, very quickly heated, not totally cooked, and to kill some of the biological activity that would reduce the shelf life in the freezer. And so those are not going to suffer from the same kind of risks as fresh food does. In terms of introducing these dangerous pathogens in the United States, they're already here because some visitors have brought those back to America in their digestive tracts. And so it's incumbent upon them, those families and the healthcare professionals that treat them, to make sure that they don't spread into the wider population in that regard. To my knowledge, this has never been in our food supply. This was never identified before in Europe. It's possible it could spread here, and we'll just have to see. We don't transfer a lot of live livestock from Europe to the United States. There's probably some breeding stock that comes in, so stay tuned. You know, we're in a global marketplace. We have the emerald ash borer destroying our trees. Our homes in rural Wisconsin are infected by these spotted lady Asian beetles that you'll hear Phil Pelletieri talk to Larry Mueller about when he's on the radio. And these are all critters that are foreign invaders, and they've come in through our international commerce.
Lee, thanks for the question. Let's go to Pat now. Pat's with us from Milwaukee. Good morning.
Good morning. I had a question about the omnivore. It's a book called The Omnivore's Dilemma.
Mm-hmm, by Michael Pollan, yeah.
Yeah, and it reinforces a lot of what you were saying about the food supply. And his follow-up book, he actually visited a feedlot, and it's kind of a frightening account of that. And I just wanted to mention that. Those are good resources for people.
Well, Pat, thanks for the tip. And Mark Castell, you know, 20 years ago, were we reading about things like this? Were we having these sorts of discussions?
Well, no, and that this is a byproduct, as I say, out of the organic and fresh local food movements. Michael, who I know, featured a farmer, Joel Salatin, who is a local producer from Virginia. Joel and I were just speaking at an event in Seattle. This is the example of where we know our farmers. We can visit the farm. In almost every case, the farmers who have displays at the farmer's market, or that you sign up for their CSA every year, they have open houses or they invite visitors. They're not secretive. On the other end of the spectrum, we have legislation going through states like Florida and Iowa right now proposing to make it a crime, even a felony, for clandestinely taking photos of violations that occur on these giant CAFOs, these concentrated animal feeding operations. So know your farmer, know your food. It's an initiative right now out of the White House, and I think it probably pays food safety dividends in the long run.
Let's go to Kevin, and Kevin is with us from Chicago. Good morning.
Good morning.
You're
my
on...
question? Yes?
Go ahead.
My question is, I've had the luxury of being able to shop at local grocery stores such as Outpost Foods for years. I live in a smaller town, and when I am not able to get to Outpost Foods, we're locked into buying organic at a large corporate grocery store, and that organic food comes from Dole or some other large corporation. Years ago, I heard of the corporations, whether or not it's true, trying to weaken the organic laws. Is there a difference between the organics I would get at the Outpost and trust implicitly and what we would get from, say, a Pick and Save and Dole?
Mark, Kevin, thanks for the question. Mark Castell, that's a pretty broad topic.
Sure. Well, first, let me reference the Outpost. It's the a member-owned food cooperative in Milwaukee. There's about 300 around the country from... And in Wisconsin, you know, Willie Street Co-op in Madison, or Stevens Point Food Co-op, or the Viroqua Food Co-op, there are a lot around in our state. And these are kind of like a farmer's market 7 days a week. These are retailers that, anywhere from small storefronts to multi-million-dollar operations, that have forged a relationship with local farmers, and they do some of the inspections and vetting. So I think there's a high degree of credibility there. The organic system, although it's not perfect, is still the gold standard. There isn't any other food that's scrutinized with independent inspections, with the letter of the law passed by Congress to enforce this. And although there might be a difference between your local farmer and something organic from Dole, if I was buying bananas in the store, I would definitely buy organic, and I can't get them locally. And during periods of the year where I can't get local organic produce, I might very well be buying some of the organic products coming from larger corporations. So that's part of our job at the Cornucopia Institute. I'd invite your readers to learn more about this, or your listeners, if they're interested, by visiting cornucopia.org, our website, and that's CORNUCOPIA. But like you, Lee, I think it was, Patrick? There are many people looking for organic food for that extra level of security and nutrition, and I'd encourage you to keep doing that.
Okay, Patrick, thanks for the call. If you'd like to join in, 800-642-1234. We've got a couple minutes left and a couple open lines for you as well. Tom is with us from Port Wing. Hi.
Good morning. I have a question. As a producer of beef, and I produce both ways, either grain-fed or grass-fed. If I take a grass-fed animal and send it to the grain-fed market, I'm docked. The animal is considered low quality. What I'm looking for is a place to market that's as easy as the regular market, the grain market, for beef-fed, you know, beef animals. And is there anything like that set up for grass-fed animals?
Well, not quite as sophisticated as we have for feedlot or grain-finished beef, but there is a new cooperative in Wisconsin. I think it's called the Wisconsin Grass-Fed Beef Cooperative, but you're going to have to do a little noodling and Googling around to find that. And there are some purchasers of beef that there's Organic Valley based here in Wisconsin. There is a couple other larger marketers of, and Organic Valley does both grass-finished and grain-finished beef. And there are a couple other larger marketers that are exclusively grass-finished. So I think you're going to have to do your research. If you go to the cornucopia.org website, you might be able to use the search function there to find some of these marketers. But I applaud your efforts. There have also been studies that show that if you take the average feedlot animal and you feed that cow 100% hay or forage during the last couple weeks of its life after it's been fattened on beef, that it changes the pH in the colon back and cleans out the digestive system and virtually eliminates these dangerous strains of E. coli. So there are things you can do yourself as a beef producer to make your food safer.
You know what, as I've been listening to the calls and concerns coming in from people, it reminds me, though, that most people listening today probably aren't particularly ill from the food that they've eaten. And how do you counteract that when most of the time most people probably feel pretty good for the food they eat?
Well, I'm not interested in being a scaremonger. I'm interested in people making educated decisions. But almost all of us have experienced those gastrointestinal problems, and these are almost exclusively from bugs that we get through our food supply, although they could be from shaking hands with somebody who's ill. And we know what the extreme downside is, and that's serious illness, kidney failures in Europe now, and paralysis and dialysis, and in some cases death. So it's not something to be taken lightly just because we eat breakfast this morning and have no problems. But the majority of our food is safe in this country, both conventional and organic. But we can do a heck of a lot better and lower down the risk. And that's, I think, what this discussion is all about.
And you've said one of the byproducts of the E. coli outbreak has been discussions like these taking place. As you look forward 5 or 10 years, do you see these discussions getting more robust? Do you feel as though, in other words, that you're making some progress?
Well, it will depend, Gene, on whether or not people look at this big elephant in the room and say that we want to prevent these organisms from entering our food supply instead of trying to remediate them. There's a new push for irradiating all of our food, and that basically denatures it and takes away some of the nutrition and possibly creates dangerous byproducts, novel chemicals through the process that have never been part of our food supply. So it remains to be seen if we take this seriously. Obviously, we're always going to have some level of contamination in our food because our food is created not in a hermetically sealed greenhouse, but it's out there in nature, and we have to respect that.
Well, Mark Castell, thank you for joining us today.
It's been my pleasure, Gene. Thank
Appreciate your time. Mark Castell has been with us for the past 50 minutes or so, the co-director and senior farm policy analyst at the Cornucopia Institute. It's based in Wisconsin. Its website says it engages in educational activities supporting the ecological principles and economic wisdom underlying sustainable and organic agriculture. We've been talking about food safety this hour. We will be back in just a moment. First, though, let's take a quick look at Wisconsin weather for today. It is going to be partly cloudy across the state. It's going to be pretty mild, too. Expect highs in the lows to mid-70s. Tonight, partly to mostly cloudy skies again with a chance of showers, possibly some thunderstorms in the western part of the state. Lows back down to the low 40s to the mid-50s, and then tomorrow it'll be partly to mostly cloudy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms mostly all over the state. As a matter of fact, look for highs in the lows to mid-70s. Around Wisconsin now, it's 54 under clear skies in Green Bay. Superior, 53 in clear. Wausau, 46 in clear. Oshkosh, 50 in clear. It's 45 and clear in Eau Claire, 60 and mostly cloudy in La Crosse. It is 54 and clear in Madison, and Milwaukee reports 52 degrees under clear skies. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Nine minutes before 7 o'clock, it's time for the Monday morning wake-up call. It's a newish segment where we bring on a guest who wants to tell us something that may not be getting a whole lot of attention. This week's wake-up call comes from Wisconsin Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen. J.B. Van Hollen, good morning. Welcome to Wisconsin Public Radio.
Good morning, Gene. Great to be on again.
It is good to have you here, and we are talking this morning about internet predators. And I'm wondering, this is something, of course, that is in the news occasionally. Is there something new here that you want to bring to our attention?
Well, there's always something new, which is why internet predators are such a danger to our children. Obviously, we have great benefits that have come to us with technology and the internet, but with the benefits to us, unfortunately, come benefits to criminals as well. And so criminals of all sorts, but we're most specifically concerned about child predators, have been using the internet increasingly to prey on our children and to share child pornography, which further victimizes our children and our society. And it's been a mission of mine since I became Attorney General to not only find these people and take them off the streets, but also to educate the general public, children and parents alike, as to the dangers of the internet, so that these children can be protected and we can prevent some of this victimization as well.
Now, I imagine there's been a lot of progress made in how you investigate these sorts of things over the years. And I think one of the interesting things people might not be aware of is that Department of Justice partners with a lot of local law enforcement agencies throughout the state. And I also understand that you partner with Boys and Girls Clubs as well.
We do, because it's very important to us that we make this network as large as possible. When I took over as Attorney General, there were a couple of dozen or so law enforcement agencies who had been trained and equipped to help fight these kind of crimes and detect these sorts of criminals. We're now up to 168 partners in our Wisconsin ICAC affiliation. We also partner with Boys and Girls Clubs because, as I mentioned, investigating and prosecuting and convicting and incarcerating these individuals certainly protects our kids after many have been victimized. Obviously, we'd love to prevent every child in the world from being victimized. And when we partner with places like Boys and Girls Clubs, where a lot of children, specifically at-risk children in some communities, spend an awful lot of time and have a lot of their mentors and people they listen to and spend time around, we have an opportunity to reach these children and to teach them hands-on how to use their computers safely right there at the Boys and Girls Club. So we're very grateful to many community-based organizations for working with us to help protect our kids.
And kids, of course, one part of the equation, but we can't leave out parents either. And I almost hate to say this, but in many cases, parents who may be behind their children in terms of their technological ability or their knowledge of programs and apps and all that sort of thing.
And that is one of our bigger dangers now. I believe the dangers may lessen as our children or even the younger adult generation now become the parents, because they grew up in a computerized world where you and I really didn't have PCs, and we certainly didn't have iPads and cell phones and all of those things. So what's really important for parents to do now is to understand what their kids are using technology to do. Keep their computers in safe places. Know what their children are doing online. Watch their internet use. And they can even use software that prevents their children from using the internet for inappropriate purposes. It's real important to educate our kids as to the dangers on the internet when you're chatting with somebody you don't know, that person isn't necessarily going to be who they identify themselves as. Obviously, we have adults who are posing as children to try to take advantage of our children. And the best thing I would tell parents to do is, if they don't understand technology, ask their kids to teach them. They don't have to teach them the ins and outs of how to program a computer, but they can show them what they're doing online, where they're going, how they access things. And parents should have all the passcodes and passwords to be able to monitor what their kids are doing on various social websites and interactive gaming sites and the like.
And I've heard one of the other things that parents ought to think about is where the computer, or computers as it may be, a lot of more homes these days with more than one computer, where they should be placed. Because if you've got it in a room where nobody can see what's going on, or where it's not a sort of readily accessible, that's where trouble can start.
And that's true. Parents should know where the computers are placed. However, unfortunately, just in the last few years, that doesn't appear to be enough to do either. For instance, my oldest child is a 12-year-old boy, and I think he may be the only person in his class who doesn't have a cell phone. And when you have a cell phone, you've already got the opportunity, when you're away from home, to be many times searching the internet, texting, and unfortunately sexting, where children of all ages are sending and receiving video images, photographic images of partial and complete nudity. So there's an awful lot that our kids can do when they're out of our reach based upon handheld devices now that most of them have. And so it's extremely important for parents to monitor these things and to look at them and look at some of the history and make sure they know what their children are doing to nip things in the bud before really bad things happen.
Now, if you are a parent and you suspect that a stranger might be trying to have some sort of communication with a son or daughter, how do you proceed? Because, I mean, there's that part of you that wants to give your child some space. There's that other part of you that wants to, keep them really tightly locked down.
You know, it's interesting. We talk about privacy and wanting to give our children space and that it's important on their internet usage. However, we would have never let them talk to strangers outside of the schoolyard or accept candy from strangers or get in a car with strangers, the types of things that we learned when we were younger. And our parents would have never permitted it, and they pounded that into our heads. This is no different. This becomes an issue that goes way beyond privacy. Our job, first and foremost, is to protect our children. And if the internet is one of the greatest dangers to our children right now, then by all means, we need to make sure we know what they're doing on the internet highway. I would strongly encourage parents that if they encounter anything that they believe is inappropriate, that they contact either their local law enforcement agency, or they can call the Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force in Wisconsin at 608-266-1671. We have great technology ourselves, and I've done everything possible to stay ahead of the curve. So when we get these tips, we can use our technology to try to track down those people who are looking for technology as an opportunity to abuse our children.
Well, Wisconsin Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen, we're out of time, but thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me on. It's a very important topic. I look forward to continuing to have the opportunity to enlighten the citizens of the state.
Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen on our Monday morning wake-up. We're talking about internet predators, and you can find his column on this on the Department of Justice website if you'd like to learn more. If you'd like a copy of the program, you can call the radio store at 800-747-7444. We had on-air production this morning from Chris Molina, and the program was produced by Bill Martins. I'm Gene Purcell, and I'm here all week long, filling in for Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.